My name is Megan Marie Hakkinen, and I'm a long-distance cyclist and writer from the west coast of British Columbia, Canada. I'm the author of South Away, The Pacific Coast on Two Wheels, New West Press, 2019, shortlisted for the 2020 Kobo Emerging Writer Prize in Nonfiction. I'm also a Trans Am Bike Race, Northgate 4000, and Paris Press Paris finisher, as well as the 2019 24-hour World Time Trial Champion and current course record holder in the women's division. I'm going to share some writing I've been doing on the 2017 Trans Am Bike Race. Like many people who participated in that event, it was a life-changing experience for me, and even now, 3 years later, I'm still thinking about it. My writing attempts to capture the adventure of the road, surprising friendships in unlikely places, and battling self-doubt to push beyond preconceived limits. These selections progress chronologically and are part of a more connected in-progress manuscript. I've chosen pieces that I feel stand alone without lead-up or explanation. So, let me know what you think. In these isolating times, I'm excited to receive both encouragement and critical feedback. I sincerely hope that you enjoy what I've written, and perhaps it sparks some memories of cycling adventures of your own. Either way, feel free to reach out and let me know. I'm still writing, revising, and rethinking about how all these experiences fit together as part of a larger story. If you want to get in touch, you can message me on Facebook or Instagram, or fill out the contact form on my website, meganhakkinen.com. That's meganhakkinen.com. Okay, here we go. Day one, Astoria, Oregon. The 2017 edition of the Trans Am Bike Race rolled out just after dawn in Astoria. There were no banners, no signs, just a legion of day-glow, lycra-clad cyclists in the parking lot of the Harborfront Maritime Museum, listening to race organizer Nathan Jones bellow final reminders from a bullhorn against the backdrop of a massive bronze propeller blade. "This is a bike ride, all right? It's a race, but really nobody cares," he said, pausing as nervous laughter leapfrogged through the crowd. "Nobody cares. Your family barely understands what you're doing. Your friends have no idea. And the people you don't know, they're going to think you're idiots. And you kind of are idiots." Nathan continued, but I found myself distracted, head weary from fitful before the big day sleep, scanning the crowd for the reassurance of familiar faces and sizing myself up against the competition. Statistically, only 50% of us were likely to finish. I caught the eye of DBR, a Portland cyclist who had helped organize the pre-ride to Astoria. With a brisk nod, he rolled by to wish me luck. "Remember, rubber side down," he said. Then, as an afterthought, "Do you think that's the best place for your tracker?" I had attached my spot tracker, an orange and black square the size of a coaster and the thickness of a paperback, under my seat post. Last night, I'd struggled to find a fitting location for it among frame bags and aero bars, having only picked up the tracking device at the column. "You might not get reception with it aimed at your butt," he pointed out. I stood back to examine my bike, bracing the frame with both hands. "Maybe I could strap it to the handlebars?" "Do it quick," said DBR, wheeling toward another face in the crowd. Just then, legendary Lantern Rouge Thomas Camaro marched by with a bottle of champagne, a tower of plastic cups protruding from his pocket. "Hold my bike?" I asked. He agreed, tucking the bottle precariously under an arm. I felt lightheaded. Only 5 minutes. Less now. My trembling fingers struggled to pinch the zipper of the top tube bag where I'd stored my Swiss Army knife. Stupid nerves. I popped open the blade and nicked my thumb attempting to cut the zip ties, attaching my spot tracker to the seat post. "Here," said Thomas, seeing the smidge of blood, my electric anxiety. We traded places. He took the knife from my hand, passing the champagne off to a nearby racer. As Thomas sliced my spot tracker free, I instinctively stuck my thumb in my mouth. A few seconds later, he had secured the device to my handlebars with another set of zip ties I directed him to pull from my larger frame bag. "Thanks," I said, grateful but blushing embarrassment for failing to complete even this minor task alone. I didn't need anyone to remind me that once we rolled out, I'd be solely responsible for taking care of my own problems. Thomas grinned, retrieving the champagne and ceremoniously bequeathing an inch of bubbly into a plastic cup for me. The fizz sloshed in my jittery hands like the tumultuous Columbia River streaming by the harbor. Other racers clinked rims in delight, I wondered how I even got there, struck yet again, for the umpteenth time in the past week, by the magnitude of the colossal challenge I'd signed up for. Suddenly, we were counting down to the grand depart. I slugged back the champagne, crushing the plastic cup into a jersey pocket. A cheer erupted, bystanders snapped photos. We were off, jostling shoulders in our high-vis vests like a school of yellow snapper fleeing Astoria's misty shores. Day 2, Mackenzie Pass, Oregon. I continued alongside serpentine creeks and pretty vanilla horses, the sun still tucked behind a thickening tree line. Mackenzie Pass, the race's first major hurdle, loomed large, unseen yet legendary. A 5,325-foot climb over the Cascade Range, Mackenzie Pass promised to be an early predictor of podium favorites, most of whom ascended the night before with little or no sleep. This morning would take me through lush wilderness on the western slope, the road curling up an ancient lava field before flying down the other side, the Three Sisters Range standing sentinel over Ponderosa Pine below. Already, the throng of racers had thinned. Every once in a while, I'd shoot past a guy relieving himself in the trees, but mostly, I rode alone. After breakfast in Mackenzie Bridge, about 60 miles from the church where I started that morning, I turned off for the climb. As the sun rose, temperatures surged. Impossible to believe the pass had only been open less than a week ago, when plows came through to remove several feet of snow. 7 days earlier, I was still accumulating training miles in Saskatchewan. A series of tight, switched-back turns traced an old wagon trail up the pass, the mountainside a steady and green. Thin-needle conifers mingled with leafy maples, the roadside skirted by salal and huckleberry. Bird calls pierced a hymnal of rustling leaves. The top of half of the pass remained closed to vehicle traffic. I found myself overtaken instead by road cyclists, Sunday warriors with fresh legs and no superfluous gear. They zipped past, leaving me gasping in their wake. One of these riders happened to be the dot watcher from the Corvallis Husky gas station, who I met the evening before. This time, it was me offering encouragement as he passed, and I stood munching a granola bar on the road's edge. Gradually, trees diminished, first in size, then altogether. Frenetic green replaced by volcanic debris, a moonscape of lava rock. I donned my jacket as snow accumulated, its crusty skiff blanketing rubble like globular marshmallow topping on rocky road brownies. As I neared the summit, the snowbank piled high enough to form a sheer vertical wall to my right. A chill bit my ankles. Tiny hairs on my arms and legs buzzed electric in the frigid air as yesterday's coastal capes and sea lion bezeled fizzled from memory like dissolving clouds. My presence on this mountaintop of extremes, summer snowdrifts coupled with the remnants of a volcanic eruption, elicited a thrill, a sensation of almost criminal delight. Devoid of traffic, I tuned in to the mountain's frequency, the crackle of snowmelt under radiant sunshine, the surge of wind mingling with the wheeze of my own strained lungs. Day 5, Highway 12, Idaho. By midday, temperatures were sweltering. I continued to ride with Matthias, a German cyclist with razor-sharp tan lines and a quiet determination who I met that morning in Whitebird. We chatted alongside each other, falling into single file when a car approached. Then traffic picked up, forcing us to abandon any semblance of conversation. I glanced at my odometer, the numbers hardly moving in the burgeoning heat. By noon, I felt disoriented. The scenery unchanging, river to our right, forest to our left, mile after blazing mile. You would expect someone familiar with riding in the prairies to be accustomed to repetition, but it got to me. I wondered if we were in Oregon, Montana, or Idaho. The grade remained imperceptible, though I sensed my speed lagging, the tedium wearing me down. Sharp pain splintered at my temples, dehydration or frustration, the frightful supposition we might actually be stuck in time. Matthias and I continued to squeeze sweat from our brows. The scenery hadn't changed for hours when we pulled into a gravel patch and scrambled down a rock scree toward the Clearwater River, seeking relief from stifling heat and endless trees barring us in on the road to Lolo Pass. Two sets of cleats ground against smooth river stones banking the water's edge, empty water bottles in hand. We peeled off socks, shoes. left sweat-soaked jerseys on a boulder to dry and wiggled toes the pale, sickly color of deep-sea worms to tiptoe into water on legs uncertain, reluctant to commit to movement off the bike. Scents of asphalt and car exhaust wiped clear by the kinetic energy of surging white water. I kneeled into the torrent and gripped my teeth, embracing the stabbing cold and hard rock against shins. A few feet away, Matthias lowered himself as well, his face contorting, eyes alternately creased shut and blinking wide from the shock. "Dare you to put your head under," I said. He flashed an expression of revulsion, horror, and then dunked, came up screaming. "Now you," he said. I breathed in, imagining a much younger self, a girl, fearlessly diving into a Pacific kelp bed to swim down to the octopus's lair to listen for mermaids singing from depths beneath. I sealed my lips and thrust my face under, the coursing current drowning out my own hammering heart. 1, 2 seconds. Bolts of lightning, stars exploding in the back of my retinas, the intertwining of pain and joy, water crashing overhead as I held my breath in a dare from a shivering, lycra-clad German. Day 6, Wisdom, Montana. Wind tore through Wisdom, Montana, chewed flags to streamers but did little to hinder the mosquitoes. An entire shelf in the gas station dedicated to bug spray. Big Hole Cologne, Big Hole the name of the river that transects town. I bumped into Matthias again en route to Wisdom, and now he chuckled as I snapped a photo of the handwritten sign, though neither of us was laughing as we were chased from our picnic table lunch by a scourge of bloodthirsty mosquitoes. We hit the road, sandwiches in hand, tore off doughy bites of deli meat while pedaling just fast enough to stay ahead of the swarm, buzzing louder than a chainsaw at our heels. Luckily, the breeze had our backs. In my imagination, a cartoon cloud face whistling wind through pursed lips, and we soared, effortless, easy miles. Endless pasture, distant peaks. Montana lived up to its name, Big Sky Country. Occasionally, a ghost town, a solitary log home puffing smoke from a stone chimney. Clouds gloomed dark overhead, mirroring snow-capped mountain ranges. Clouds gloomed dark overhead, mirroring snow-capped mountain ranges in shades of periwinkle and gray. But rain was not forecast, so we relaxed, leaned into the bars to listen to sweetgrass dancing as we gazed down the double solid line of a highway that was ours alone for miles and miles and miles. Day 11, Pueblo, Colorado. We rolled into Pueblo at 2 a.m., another long haul behind us. During the day, I snapped photos of the monstrous club sandwich I devoured for lunch in Hartzell, an elevation sign at Hoosier Pass as we summited the spine of the Rockies, even Matthias, frustratedly fixing his third flat in as many days, swearing as his new pump proved as useless as his last. But after dark, a camera becomes an ill-suited tool to capture the stillness, the dragging minutes on the outskirts of Pueblo as we pulled closer to our nighttime destination, street lamps humming atomic tangerine and mailboxes perched close together. As we ghosted into town, I noticed a street sign reading Goodnight Boulevard and exhaled into a silence so all-encompassing it was as though the entire world had fallen asleep. I smiled inwardly, counting door knockers on single-story homes as I imagined all those strangers tucked in next to loved ones or animals, stuffed or real, and then Matthias and I saying goodnight to saddle sores, knee aches, and headaches. Goodnight to these husks we call bodies and the ceaseless endeavor of forward momentum, another 200-mile day in the books. Goodnight, goodnight, goodnight as we collapse into two ragged heaps in some dive hotel room, stiff mattresses, and a 24-hour reception. Long after I returned to the Canadian prairies, it would be these unremarkable glimpses of America that remained stuck to me, the makings of a scrapbook from photos I didn't take, yet able to conjure the road-worn ache of fleeting adventure in the briefest blink of an eye. Day 19, Sonora, Kentucky. Clouds parted as we rode towards Sonora, revealing blue sky and promise of a clear night. I inhaled deeply as I dug into a climb, the fragrance of grass and wet earth suddenly thicker after rainfall. Sonora was just a name on the map at a crossroads, significant to us only because it marked where we'd reserved a room at a bed and breakfast. Everything in my seatpost bag was soaked, but the prospect of a good sleep in dry bedding put me in a better mood. I pulled over on a hilltop to remove my rain jacket, fighting once again with the zipper. A sound I mistook for thunder reverberated across glistening clover fields, and I squinted past a rickety fence to see distant horses galloping in play. A perfect moment. I paused for Matthias to catch up so I could point out the horses, though surely he would notice. While I waited, my mind spun back to that lingering question, why was I doing this? Suddenly, it seemed so simple, all this time. I had been overthinking it, when the answer existed in the most universal tenet of travel. Why does anyone travel anywhere? To find out what is out there. I could locate my why, not just in the overarching goal of reaching Yorktown, but in any moment of the travel itself. I trained my eyes into the fields to follow brown and white horses as they cantered past a backdrop of achingly blue sky, my cheeks pulled tight into a grin. This, here, this is it. All the while I'd been searching for a profound explanation, but the explanation stood right in front of me. Just like the million shades of green in Kentucky's countryside, there was not just one, but infinite explanations for my journey. Unpredictable and circumstantial, they revealed themselves as I encountered them, at times surprising, disappointing, and overwhelming. To know the sound of horses romping in wet pasture, to learn to maneuver one's fingers without sensation or feeling, to soak in the day's final rays after a storm. While far from cultivating a zen-like acceptance of each passing moment, from that point on I became more at ease. I didn't owe myself or anyone else an explanation other than my sincere desire to experience the world outside my doorstep.